Next to Normal, featuring the Tony winner from that show, Alice Ripley, I Miss the Mountains. Well, don't miss this next segment of Dave's Gone By, because we have that vocalist, that actress with us in the neighborhood. She is the winner of the 2009 Tony and 2009 Helen Hayes Awards for that show, Next to Normal. She was also Tony nominated for Sideshow. She was on Broadway in such shows as Sunset Boulevard, Les Mis, and the Rocky Horror Show. She was just off-Broadway in Wild Animals You Should Know, and if that weren't enough, she's got three albums out, including one with her band Ripley. The latest album is the acoustic one called Daily Practice, and there's a single that we're going to play just at the end of the interview called Beautiful Eyes. And she does have beautiful eyes and beautiful everything else. She's Alice Ripley, and she's on the phone with us. Hello, Alice. Good morning.
Hey, Dave. How's Colorado?
It's Colorado. It's beautiful. There's nothing else to say. I mean, it's cold.
Blue sky today.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I bet you have a blue sky today.
Yep, we do. It's like 300 and something days a year of sunshine. I was just, earlier in the show, we were talking to Judy Collins, who is, of course, a Colorado devotee. And that was the first thing she said, oh, it's Colorado. It looks like Colorado. It, you know, nothing else quite like it. How's New York doing?
It's actually beautiful today. It feels like spring, and it's the first day we've had like that, and so everybody's face has a ray of hope on it.
They just want to prove the groundhog wrong. That's basically that.
Yeah, exactly. What does he know?
So, since this is a college radio station, University of Northern Colorado Radio, let's roll it back to your college years. You have a BFA in musical theater from Kent State, and wondering, you know, how you chose to do that, and also how important you think that training and classes are as a lifelong theater and musical theater person.
Well, ever since I was a kid, I knew what I wanted to do. So I knew that when I went to college, it would be to study acting and music. By the time I got to the college age, there was I went to DePaul University in Indiana, which is a small school, and studied music. I was a vocal performance major, even though I wanted to study acting. They didn't have any acting there, so I ended up transferring to Kent State, which it sounds, I don't know, it sounds kind of frivolous in a way, but, you know, Kent State, actually, they had a program for musical theater. You could get a BFA in musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, you know, they still have that, and now it's common for colleges to offer this.
But then...
But it wasn't the case at the time. Kent State was one of the first colleges that offered that degree. And so, you know, I transferred there and got my degree there, and I studied, you know, I guess a degree in musical theater is really a trip major. Dance, acting, and music. So you don't become a master at all three of them, but what you do in college is, you, with that kind of a liberal arts education, you get saturated in the work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's all about when you're in this business, is the actual work. Now, acting classes are useful. Of course, vocal lessons, musical lessons are useful, but they you put them to use while you're working, while you're on stage, or while you're actually practicing, or while you're actually performing. So I think that it's important to get a college education for reasons other than what you're actually studying, because I think that college is a place for you to grow up and figure out how you're going to pay these bills, and that you actually have to pay them. You know, you can't just ignore them. I think that college is a useful place to grow up. And, you know, if you end up learning something from your classes, too, well, that's good. When you're a creative artist, you learn the most while you're actually doing it.
Mm.
So a lecture isn't going to be as useful to you as an actor or as a creative artist as is actually doing a show.
Do you remember
You'll
some
learn
of
a lot more actually doing it.
Do you remember some of the shows that you did when you were getting your BFA?
Oh, yeah. Well, my very first role in college was Meg in Brigadoon.
Oh.
First semester. And I did Sweeney Todd, and I played Mrs. Lovett, which seems ridiculous because I was only 19. It's really, you know, I mean, I think she's a little bit older than
a little. Well, everybody said Helena Bonham Carter
playing a role like Mrs. Lovett at that age is you end up, you know, it ends up forging something in you. It galvanizes your chops. Because even though you're only 19, you have to still take it in and digest it and make it work, you know. And that's the kind of training that I'm talking about. That's the kind of training that really is effective for you, and less so sitting in a room listening to a lecture. Although, like I said, you know, you get it from everywhere. It's a liberal arts experience there, you know. So you're growing through your whole experience of being in college, not just sitting in class.
Well, do you still take classes or lessons or vocal warm-ups or dance warm-ups? I mean, how do you stay in condition to do musical theater?
I do. I have a voice teacher that I'm taking a hiatus for her, but I've been studying with her for years. And without Joan, her name is Joan Later.
Mm-hmm.
Without her guidance and instruction and faith, I wouldn't have been able to play the role of Diana, the woman that you were talking about earlier. The track that you played, that's Diana singing.
Right.
And I wouldn't have been able to do it without my voice teacher helping me through.
What is it that they give you? What are certain, even specific things that they told you that you would not have known had you not been with them, had you just gone on and done, because you've already been in a few Broadway musicals. So what is it that you learned from them that has allowed you to do Diana and save your voice and, you know, not go mad doing the role?
So you mean why keep taking lessons, right? Is
that what you mean? Yeah, well, what did you learn from the lessons from them that you wouldn't have known when you first started doing, like, Tommy or Sunset Boulevard? I mean, what knowledge did you accumulate that allowed you to take on a much more kind of a role like Diana in Next to Normal?
Well, I believe that an actor draws roles to them, and they appear in front of you, and then you have to know when the right one is in front of you, and you grab it, and that's what happened with Diana. And I believe that I don't think I could have played Diana until exactly the moment when I started to approach her, because she's very complicated, and she's you know, about the age that I am now, maybe a little bit younger. And you know, you have to reach a certain point in your creative playground. You have to reach a certain point in your imagination and in your work where you're ready to play something, and then it finds you. That's what I believe. And in other words, I don't think I couldn't have played Diana 10 years ago because I didn't have what it took. You know, and that's why it's so comforting to me when I think about Sanford Meisner, who was one of our great acting teachers of the last century. He wrote a book called On Acting. It's a thin volume. You can roll it up and stick it in your back pocket. And something that he said in there was that it takes 20 years to become an actor, which, you know, when you're 20, what I did was just cast that aside, and I said, well, that doesn't apply to me. Because that's what you have to do to make it. But the truth is, it is true. It's true, and it's a good thing. It's a relief to face this and embrace it. Because even though at the age of 20, when you're studying theater and music in school, you want to have it now. You want to be ready to do it now. You feel like you've already waited because you wanted to do this since you were 5. It's been 15 years, and you're still waiting. You know, so. It's a relief to read Sanford Meisner's book and realize that he's right, that it takes 20 years. Not that that's a punishment, but it's a gift. You don't have to have it right now. Give yourself 20 years to become an interesting person who's charismatic and has your act together off stage, George Clooney, okay? And then you become that charismatic person on stage or on camera, because George Clooney can just turn off his personality. He takes it with him everywhere he goes, and he developed that in his real life. And that's what charisma is, I think.
Okay.
Don't you? I mean, isn't it, charisma is like living a full life and being saturated with all things and somehow making something beautiful out of it that you can use to connect with other people.
Okay. No, I mean, I don't know George Clooney enough or know him personally. I've just been watching Up in the Air, and yes, he certainly has that charisma on camera. I don't know about his real life. Are you guys friends or something, or you just know this from the Ozone?
One of my secret boyfriends in my dreams.
Oh. Okay.
No, I like to use him as an example of somebody who has a lot of charisma.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I can say to a teenager, George Clooney might have had, you know, he was attractive, but he used that time as he was growing up to build his...
Oh, okay.
...his persona. And so he happens to be a film actor, but I like to talk to the students and tell them that they can give themselves a break. They can give themselves 20 years to become charismatic or to become interesting or to become an actor that actually understands this complicated situation and this relationship in the script without it having to be hit over the head over and over. Like, they get it right away the first time they read it. That comes from life experience.
True.
Because you've been in a complicated relationship.
And
that's how you can look at the script and go, well, I can understand why she would want to do that even though this is what she's supposed to be doing. And she's not telling anybody about it. Those are the kind of things that you have to live life before you can understand that kind of a, you know, how that character ticks, what makes that character do what it does and behave in the way that he or she does.
Well, now speaking of relationships, though, you married a drummer. I mean, didn't you know girls are not supposed to marry drummers?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about anybody but me.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
This interview is about me.
Well, excuse me. Well, he is in your band, so you can't really
That's
avoid...
That's true.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean...
I have a band, and it's a three-piece band. Drums, guitar, and keyboard. Although, on the single that we just... or that we're going to release on Tuesday, it's called Beautiful Eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That single is... it's a single. It's not on an album. The Daily Practice album you mentioned is... That's an album I released last year of all rock covers. Beautiful Eyes is a single that I wrote, and Ripley recorded, we self-produced it. And I have to say, it's pretty catchy. I can't imagine somebody, you know, not finding something about it that they like.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I'm going to play it as soon as our interview's done. Unless you want me to play it now, if you want to wait.
I'm ready to follow your lead.
Oh, well, thank you so much. We'll wait, because I'm having fun talking to Alice Ripley here in the...
I'm trying to keep it in sound bites, but...
Oh, I'm not good at the whole soundbite thing. I've only been doing radio 9.5 years, and yet I still haven't figured out how to do a sentence without 12 parenthetical phrases that trail off into nothing.
Well, I think it's okay as long as you bring it back around. You know, that's what I try to do. I mean, I might go out into... different atmospheres with what I'm saying, going on tangent, but then I try to bring it back around to what we're talking about.
Well, true. And also I have to bring it back to you, because it's certainly all about you.
Exactly. Thank you.
I do have to ask, when I was researching and trying to figure out what questions to ask, I went on Google and YouTube, and I saw all these videos that you did, which are kind of weird. What was that all about from like 2-3 years ago? Was that you getting in mental shape to play Diana, or were you just having fun, or were they promos for the band? They're like 30 seconds. What?
It's funny. There is no mean. There's no reason. There's no meaning to them, and there's no reason. It started out as almost like acting experiments, where I would take one line, and I would video myself saying this line. It could be anything,
mm-hmm.
I'd set up a frame. And I have about 300 of these videos now that people can go look at. So this is what I would do. I'd set up some kind of shot that was interesting or looked good, you know, and it would be a still shot, and I would do it to myself. I would hold the camera up, you know, and take a video of myself. And so the rule was, the rule is with these videos is I'm not allowed to do them over, and I'm not allowed to practice.
Hmm.
So that's something that the viewer would never know, and they don't really even need to know. But if you look at each individual video, they might seem silly and meaningless, but the idea is to look at the big picture of them. If you look at all of them together, you see me.
Hmm.
You see me. I mean, I'm just being silly and ridiculous. That's all there is to it. Some of them are a little more serious than others.
Right.
But they're really just experiments in exercises in ridiculousness. And some people are irritated by them, which is funny to me. It's like, go watch them if you don't like them.
Yeah, and stop them at 10 seconds.
Most people are entertained, and they enjoy them very much because they tell me so.
Yeah, they're cute. They're little interstitial, odd things. I was just wondering
they're
where.
Short. Most of them are. I tried to keep them real short, but then I decided I'll make some that are just 3 minutes long because that's about how long I should expect to keep someone's attention. You know, and I started making them 3 minutes, but a lot of them were in the beginning. They were 10 seconds, yeah. 6 seconds, 12 seconds, and what you're really seeing was a moving still image. But it was a still frame. What you see. But then I'll have like a couple of lines that I say, silly lines, something silly that I do to the camera. And it was really fun for me to do. It was kind of like a performance art that I was doing for myself and capturing and then sharing with anybody, any fans that might be interested.
Huh. I mean, that's. Can I ask, it's a question that probably a lot of actors and people get asked. Do you have to be so, and you made a joke about it, it's like, you know, this is interview is about you, it's you. But do actors kind of have to be that way forever, of sort of really kind of both self-involved and also sort of turning out that spotlight every minute to say like, oh, no, me, because I'm kind of like that, I admit.
You know what's funny is, it's funny because if you're going to do it effectively, this acting thing, it's like a constant play between self-promotion and self-absorption and then complete detachment. Because you have to be completely absorbed in your imagination and completely absorbed in the idea that you would like to invest in, right, the creative idea. You'd want to invest your energy in. But then you have to be detached from the results.
Mm-hmm.
And also, actors are the product. Actors are the raw material. And actors are like, they're a milk carton. An actor's a milk carton that you pick up and you sell or you buy. You know, it's a product. And the thing is, it's not my job to promote my work. It's really someone else's job. Someone goes to school to learn how to promote, you know, art.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's theater or music or whatever. But I still have to know as much as I can about promoting it. And that's the thing. It's like, it's funny because you think that actors are self-absorbed, and yet actors mostly do not like to promote themselves. They're not good at sending out email blasts or the business side of it. And I really think it's because they're really actually absorbed in their work. Now, ego is something else, right? Ego's... Mm-hmm. Ego's not really even related.
Oh.
Doesn't have to be related to a specific feel at all. It could be anything. But I think that when you're talking about a creative imagination, and that's what an actor and a musician uses, yeah, you're self-absorbed in that way. I'm often the last one to look up and go, oh, man, I should be gone by now because I'm over in the corner doing something.
Hmm.
You know, and the lights come on and I'm the last one standing. Oh, that's right, I was supposed to take off already. I'm so absorbed in whatever I was doing over there. In the corner, you know? You understand? Does that make any sense, or...?
Kinda. I mean, again, because I do some performing. I'll be doing a show in New York in a couple of weeks, so I'm also trying to figure out who I am as a person before I have to get up on that stage and do the show myself, too. So that's why...
You have to be detached from the work, but absorbed in your imagination. So sometimes actors seem preoccupied, and it might seem like they're preoccupied with their only with their own things, but, you know, I guess that's just the way it's going to look.
Now, can I ask...
To others.
I'm also going back to some of the singing things, is that there's been something of a sea change in the type of music that we consider Broadway music these days, for the most part. I mean, over the past 10 or 20 years. And so, yes, you had the Rodgers and Hammerstein and the Sondheim and the Candor and Ebb, but now... It's just as much everything from, you know, Bill Finn to Tom Kitt. And so is it different to sing the old-style Broadway from the more kind of pop contemporary Broadway?
Well, I'll tell you the truth for me, and that is that a song like I Had Myself a True Love from St. Louis Woman, which was written by Harold Arlen and Johnny Mercer, I just sang it the other night. It's easier to sing classic tunes. It's easier to sing something from Oklahoma or Brigadoon than it is to sing something from the contemporary rock scores that we have today.
Because?
Part of it is the wear and tear of doing it every day with rock music. I mean, this is not an orchestral sound. There are amplifiers on stage, and you're standing right next to them. and they're loud. And they're loud 8 times a week for 2 hours at a time. This is not like strings in the pit. No, this is a band on stage with you. So this is not Brigadoon. And it is very challenging. Very challenging because, first of all, you can't hear yourself. Because it's rock music. I mean, if I were singing, let me think. If I were singing Sunset Boulevard, which is what I originated, I created the role of Betty Schaefer on Broadway with Glenn Close's Norma Desmond. You know, there's strings, there's an orchestra in the pit. It's a traditional sounding musical theater score. I sang that show for 2 years, and I don't think I ever missed a show. Except for my vacations.
Whereas?
Next to Normal is a rock score that's where I sing 30 of the 40 songs. And it's an opera, meaning that the songs dovetail and they overlap, sung through. And that is... I'll tell you what, Bruce Springsteen doesn't do 8 shows a week.
True. I mean, he does 3.5-hour shows
a week. An opera singer doesn't sing 8 shows a week. So... rock opera makes you scratch your head and wonder how anybody could do it 8 times a week. And so when you end up somehow actually accomplishing that, it's something of a miracle. But you still only have one day off a week when you're an actor on the stage.
Right.
Monday, and usually. So when you're on the road traveling and you have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday night, and you have a 5-show weekend, so you have Friday, 2 Saturday, 2 Sunday, and you have Monday off. That's your week, every week, for months.
Right.
And often you do a one-weeker, I think in Denver we were there for 2 weeks, but if you do a one-weekers in a row on the road, you travel on Monday, so you don't have a day off. I'm just trying to tell you how different the scores are now than they were 50 years ago. And they didn't do 5-show weekends 50 years ago. I don't really think that they had to do as much, actually, as many shows as they do now, because now it's a real commodity. This, you know, the traveling musical theater show. It used to be something you'd go out on the road because you had to in order to come back to New York. But now the shows in New York hope that they make it on the road.
Right,
it's a great way for people to make money.
Yeah, and shows half the time they'll break even in New York. They need the road now. New York is just like you can say, oh, we played on Broadway, we got Tony nominated or a Tony Award. Now we can bring it across the country for the next 2 years and actually make a buck. You know, it's a very different sort
of. I don't think the actors really make the money. Producers that make the money and the writers and everything, but that's fine because when you take on the job of an actor, you're a tool, you're a cog, and if you think you're anything else. It's fine, but it won't serve you as best as if you assume and you understand that you're a cog and that you're there working for the whole team and that you can be replaced. But when a special role comes to you and you're the first one to have it, you have the right to say, this is my role and it was meant to be. And so I tell students that they can do that too because you need to take what's yours and own it. And you literally need to own the role, otherwise no one's going to believe you.
Well, yeah.
Playing it. You know, they're not going to believe that you're actually her.
Even if you don't originate it, you have to take it and own it. No, even if you're a spear carrier in Shakespeare, you know, you've got to know what spear carrier you are, how you're going to hold the thing, and what your relationship is to everybody else out on that stage. Weird as that may sound.
You just brought that up, Dave, because when I was in college, I was a reluctant musical theater performer. It's not that I didn't enjoy doing it and I didn't enjoy the people, because I did. I said I wanted to be an actor, and I thought there was a difference. I thought there was a difference between acting and musical theater, and there is no difference. Acting comes first, and then musical theater is what you put on top of it. But if you don't have your character rooted in reality, even if you are just a spear carrier, and I used to say back then in school, you know, I wish that the people who were the ensemble members in Oklahoma that was happening in our school at the time, I wish that they had as much commitment to what they were doing as the spear carriers in Hamlet that we were doing at the time. Just, why aren't they as committed to what they're doing? It's not because they don't care or because they aren't capable. It's because it's difficult.
Well, yeah.
That's why it's really hard to do. So when I went to see Porgy and Bess this, a few weeks ago, and I sat in the Richard Rogers Theater where I did Sideshow with Norm Lewis, and he's up there on stage with Audrey McDonald, and they're singing these duets from Porgy and Bess, I'm inside, my heart is, it's swelling, and I feel so much emotion of gratitude and love, because I'm thinking to myself, this is musical theater. This is musical theater. This is an incredible score, an incredible piece, and the people up there are professionals. I mean, they, Audra and Norm,
well, yeah,
they are, you might as well consider them to be the highest paid athletes on best team, you know, on a football team. And they are, you know, amateurs need not apply. Please, amateurs need not apply. I mean, you better know what you're doing when you get up there, because you have to serve the piece, and they do. I mean, it was incredible. So there's an example of my favorite kind of musical theater, with people who have voices that are just so incredible that you're never distracted by anything. Anything and, negative. It's just the whole thing is like a rush of beauty.
So I take it you do not feel...
To get to that point, it takes a while. You know, you can't be in college and give that kind of a performance. There's no way. You haven't lived enough life. You know, you don't know what it's like. You can't really imagine, you know, how much time has passed between when that score was written and now. It takes a while to absorb that. How much life has passed, and how many things have changed since then. But well, I guess what I'm getting around to is Stanislavski is the one that said the stage is a tightrope.
Mm-hmm.
In his book, An Actor Prepares, and he meant it literally. If you don't know, if you are not a professional, you will fall. If you don't care, that's fine, but just know everybody's going to watch you fall. So I feel like musical theater is of the fine arts that I've participated in, and I work on canvases, I play instruments, and I've been in plays and movie and television as well. Musical theater is the most difficult thing because it's live. You don't get to polish it
right, well,
afterwards. It comes out live, and that's it. And you do have to embody the lyric and the music, and it... And you have to kind of dance the emotion through your entire body, and next to normal, what I was required to do was to play a schizophrenic, borderline schizophrenic, for 2 hours, and I really didn't leave the stage for big chunks of time, and I just sobbed my eyes out every day. So I had to learn how to. As a professional, I had to learn how to cry, sob, and sing at the same time, which is really kind of actually impossible.
Only Bernadette Peters.
The only way you can learn how to do it is by practicing it.
Yeah. Bernadette Peters could do it in Sunday in the Park. She's about the best that I've ever heard manage that. It's tough.
Well, she's the one who taught everybody how to do it.
Oh, okay.
She's the one. She was one of the first emotional singing actresses.
Huh.
And to me... There is nobody else like her.
Agreed.
Partly because of that, because I watched her in concert when I was just out of college, and she was just singing in front of a microphone. She wasn't playing a character. And yet, she became the music. Like, she became the emotion of the song with her body and her voice, and, you know, her voice is just so beautiful, and she is has such physical beauty.
Still.
But she became a hero to somebody like me.
Well, yeah. I mean, at some point, I'm sure you'll be doing Follies, too. Did you get to see her in Follies, by any chance?
I didn't, and I regret that. I regret that I didn't have the chance to. Actually, a friend invited me, and I couldn't go because I was sick.
Oh, okay. It was great. It was. Can I ask, are there roles that you tried out for over the past bunch of years that you didn't get... And that you're philosophical about now, but that you wish you had them?
Yeah, I just was talking about, I did an interview with Augustine Burroughs the other day on Sirius. He has a new show. It wasn't live, it's going to air later, but I was thinking about that, actually.
Uh-huh.
While I was there. Wait, you have to remind me.
A role or a part in theater or musical theater that you tried out for, you didn't get.
I remember now. The story that I was telling was, and I don't usually tell stories like this, but I don't know, it's kind of interesting, I guess. I was up for 30 Rock.
Oh.
That show that's on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And it was down to the wire for the role that...
Jane Krakowski or...
Two screens. One in L.A. and one in New York. And I had a lot of things going for me to get it. When I didn't get that role, I was disappointed because I really would like to do television and for other reasons. But the great thing is, though, right after that, I got Next to Normal.
Well, sure.
I started working on Next to Normal. So if I'd gotten cast in 30 Rock, I wouldn't have my Tony.
There you go. Well, that's the old...
And I do get philosophical about that. That kind of a thing, because that's the kind of thing that you have to do when you're an actor, because it's personal, you know, you're not just punching a clock and working in a factory, although it feels that way. It's a personal involvement, so sometimes you can take it personally, and it's good to just, you know, improve your skills as much as you can at something like what I just did, like, you know, looking at the silver lining of it. And then after that happens enough, you start to see it, the silver lining, before you get the silver lining. You start to go, I didn't get it, but that means something else is coming.
And were there shows that you were trying out for when you were really first starting out on Broadway that you didn't get, that even maybe now in retrospect you realize you weren't ready for at that point, even, but you were auditioning for them because, of course, you have to?
Well, when I got to New York, I went through a lot of auditions. It was a full-time job for 3 months. And then when I got cast in my first show, it was Tommy, which then came to Broadway. So I kind of think that the trajectory was perfect, actually. And the other shows that I had auditioning for were not the one that was right for me. The one that was right for me was the show that was going to go to Broadway, because that was the only one that did go to Broadway of all the shows that I auditioned for. You know, the ones that I was going out for, they were like, it was Summerstock and... you know, regional theater and things like that, which...
Nothing wrong with that? Not disparaging?
Nothing wrong with it at all. As a matter of fact, the arena stage in D.C. is the commitment that Molly Smith, she runs the arena stage, the commitment that she has to the bigger picture of improving the cultural landscape of D.C. and of America, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Her commitment to our project Next to Normal is the reason why, one of the reasons why it succeeded.
So
another reason would be because Peter Marks, the reader for the Post, gave us an incredible, he gave us so much incredible support. But we did Next to Normal off Broadway, and then we took it out of town and did it at the arena, and that's when it became the show that actually worked, and then we took it to Broadway. So that's my salute to regional theaters.
Now, are you,
the regional theater actually has space, has intellectual, creative, and physical space to do something like that. Time and space to say, let's pull up our shirt sleeves and work on this and make it work. And that's exactly what they did, because when we did Next to Normal off Broadway, it didn't work.
Oh.
It just needed to be adjusted.
Hmm.
And then it worked. So, you know, I would love to go back to the arena, and I wouldn't mind working in a regional theater again. It's just that in New York, you have to live in New York when you do this, when you're on stage, because that's where all the jobs, most of the jobs are there.
True.
In New York. And I also tell students that if you want to be an actor, you better learn how to be a musical theater actor, too, because most of the jobs are there. Most of the jobs are in musical theater, and they pay better than plays.
Well, do they realize? Isn't it the same scale?
Do it. It's also really good to learn how to do it because, as I said, it's the most difficult combination of magic tricks to pull off, and then create that illusion of a character, like what Audra and Norm were doing. I forgot that she was singing, which is hard to imagine with her voice, but she was just so she just embodied the lyric in a way that, and the sound of her voice is so flawless that you're never distracted by it. So you just start to think, you start to forget that she's singing, and you're just hearing the soul of the lyric. And to me, that's ideal.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't have to be. Glenn Close did the same thing with Sunset Boulevard, and she doesn't have the same voice as Audra.
Right, but she can act the hell out of it. Yeah,
her acting was so wonderful that, and again, she was so fully embodying the lyric and the music that you forgot that she was singing.
Yep.
Same thing, different voice, but you were. I was, and I watched her when I went to LA and watched the show before it came to Broadway. I was so pulled into the performance, and I was being pulled into the lyric and the musical, the waves of music around me. And it was Glenn that was, and then when I saw Audra, it was Audra that was getting that across. And the only way that they can do that is because they're professionals, and it's a magic trick. While I was playing Diana, mm-hmm. people were convinced that I was her. People were convinced that I was a bipolar schizophrenic. Believe me, you don't want people thinking that you are one when you're not.
Well,
I played Violet Hilton. Everybody was convinced I was Emily Skinner. People used to call me Emily. She played my twin.
Right.
People
yeah.
thought I was Emily. As a matter of fact, one time I was in Sam's restaurant over here on 46th Street. I don't think it's there anymore.
No,
I
they
walked
closed
in there.
It. Yeah.
They're like, you're Emily Skinner, aren't you? No, you're Emily Skinner. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. And the reason why they thought I was her is because we played twins. We played Siamese twins. You know, people. It's compliment, I guess, because they believe the illusion.
Right.
Right?
Well,
yeah.
I don't think people really believed you were a Siamese twin, although if you check the internet and stuff, there were people who thought you were a little goofy and baggy around the time of Next to Normal. I guess that's part of it, and the way you're convincing in that.
Well, I don't know how you could be baddie and be a professional who works on Broadway and win the Tony. I just don't know how you could be baddie and do what we do. You can't.
Oh,
you can't.
No, there are actors who are batshit crazy.
Streamlined, silver bullet train. That's what these people are. You have to be that way because everybody who isn't that way falls to the side.
Yeah. I mean, if you read the obituaries, and I guess actually that does prove your point. Like when Nicole Williamson, where the news of his death came around, and you start thinking, well, he was an amazing actor, but also he alienated everyone, and as great as it could be, it basically torpedoed his career just because he was nuts and he couldn't control it, you know? And he was a raving alcoholic, but yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, it takes all kinds, and sometimes an eccentric personality rubs somebody the wrong way, and, you know, something gets misconstrued. But really, we are all people that just want to find love and connection. And through the experience of playing Diana, I found that through the character. I found it in myself in a new way, and through the character in the show, I found it in the audience. And even though the audience might not have really known the real me, it didn't matter because the show affected them on such a profound level that I felt satisfied. Just in that, I was doing where I was supposed to be. I was in my dharma, as they said.
and speaking,
my job was to deliver the emotional impact that the show has, and then the show hits the audience, and it breaks them open.
Now,
and they're alive in a new way.
Speaking
and
of...
First, I thought that was just, a whim at the beginning of our run of Next to Normal, and as I finished over 1,000 shows in a row, I realized that... No, it was universal. Everybody felt this way. Everybody in the audience. There was going to be some group of people in the audience that was going to be affected that way by the show, because the show it impacts your humanity, and it makes you want to connect with other people and maybe reveal things that you haven't revealed before.
And it's interesting that it doesn't sound like you've let go of this show yet. I mean, you've done an off-Broadway show since, you've been doing the band, but somehow it's kind of like, are you still doing or about to do Next to Normal anywhere? Because it hasn't left you yet. It's obviously like front and center in your
honestly,
consciousness.
Honestly, I wouldn't be talking about it if you hadn't brought it up.
Oh.
Seriously. I mean, if you do bring it up, you started the interview by playing the track.
Well, sure.
I'm happy to talk about it because I think that people can really learn from my experience because I did.
Because I was going to play Touch of Me anyway, you know, and we could have talked about the nudity in Rocky Horror, but I felt, let me go with the Tony-winning song instead, you know.
Well, I am still recovering from having that kind of physical trauma in my body, which is what it was to go through her. So I am still like, because when I came off the road, I went right into a movie the next day, and the very next day after that, I went filming a pilot. And so now I'm finally going, I can take a nap. I can go for a week without crying, that kind of thing.
Wow.
Shoot, I think that I have to hang up because I'm actually in someone's office, and I think they're getting ready to leave.
Oh, well, it's 11:57 here. First of all, I want to thank you for being here in the neighborhood. And I have one last question for you, because not to get too personal, but since it's about you, no kids. Is that a choice, a thing that may still happen, won't happen, hasn't happened? Kind of curious.
For what? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
The fact that raising kids is not in your... Will that ever happen? Or is there a reason, you know, you may not have a family per se, as it were?
Well,
sorry
that's
to throw...
an answer that takes a while.
Oh.
The answer takes a while. But the brief answer would be I decided to put off having kids because... I decided that a mother is a full-time job, and an acting is a full-time job. See, some people look at their kids and they say, you can go into acting, but you have to have something to back you up.
Hmm.
And to me, that is ridiculous and offensive, because acting is a legitimate field. If somebody goes into law school, you don't go, you need something to back that up. And yet there's no proof, there's no guarantee that you're going to pass the bar. There's no guarantee that you're ever going to get a client. So, see what I mean?
Yeah, you might as well do what you love.
It's insulting to a professional
uh-huh.
to hear people say you need someone to back you up. Because when you're a kid, nobody's a professional. We're all starting out. When you're a kid, you need support. So anyway, I decided that acting was a full-time job and that motherhood was a full-time job. And so the answer to your question is, you know, you can only have one full-time job.
Fair enough. But,
you know,
and it's tough. Right?
Who knows? Actually, that's something that I would think would be wonderful. If I had a kid in this next part of my life.
Ooh.
But I don't think that that's something that's really up to me.
Okay. I'm not sure if it's up to the grocer on the street. I kind of is up to you.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a natural process, isn't it? So it's not. I'm not the only one who has a say.
Oh, well, of course.
How it turns out.
Well, you know, or as I say, give the drummer some then. No, I'm kidding. But we've been talking with Alice Ripley, the wonderful and delightful and so smart and charming actress from Next to Normal, from bunches of... I didn't even get to ask about James Joyce's The Dead, which, of all things, was a very good musical that you would never think would have been a musical. And Les Mis and Rocky Horror. Congratulations on the music, on the theater, on the Tony, of course. Best of all, what's your next project? And then I'll let you go.
Well, thank you so much for having me today, and I've really enjoyed this chat. And I just want to end by reminding everybody that my next thing is Tuesday.
Oh.
Tuesday is the release of my song. And this is my child, okay? I'll say it. It sounds cliche, but that's what it is. I had a baby. I made this song all by myself. What do you think? It's only $1. And it's a single, because in these economic times, that's the way you do it in the music business. You don't really, it's not smart to make albums anymore.
Well.
Make a single, because if you buy a whole album, you might not like everything on it. You bought it for the one song, but you know, it might not like everything else. So, you know, this way you can just buy one track if you want to. If there are other ways that you can find it online, too. It's also going to be on Bandcamp, which is a site that you can... We're going to have the listener price, so you can even pay more for it than $1 if you wanted to.
Okay, well,
anyway, I'm really excited about it because of what I've said already. And there's a video that's made, too, that's going to be released. So I hope that everybody goes there and enjoys it and lets me know what they think, because it's real easy to find me online, on Twitter, on Facebook... Like you said, my YouTube channel.
Right.
Twitter is actually the easiest way to connect to the audience. And I adore the audience, so I do hope that they give me feedback about the song after they hear it.
Well, everybody.
And my Twitter name is Ripley the Band.
Ripley the Band is Alice Ripley's Twitter name, and we are going to get to hear her brand new song. Well, it's released on Tuesday, so you can't hear it. This is the only place, actually, you can hear it for the next couple of days, and then you can go and buy it. It's called Beautiful Eyes, and thank you so much to the beautiful eyes and soul and mind and spirit of Alice Ripley for being
thank
with us.
Thank you so much, Dave, for everything. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.